Chapter 19. Agent Bruder stood in the humble apartment and tried to make sense of what he was seeing.
Who the hell lives here?
The decor was sparse and jumbled, like a college dorm room furnished on a budget. Agent Bruder? One of his men called from down the hall. You'll want to see this. As Bruder made his way down the hall, he wondered if the local police had detained Langdon yet. Bruder would have preferred to solve this crisis in-house, but Langdon's escape had left little choice but to enlist local police support and set up roadblocks. An agile motorbike on the labyrinthine streets of Florence would easily elude Bruder's vans, whose heavy polycarbonate windows and solid puncture-proof tires made them impenetrable, but lumbering. The Italian police had a reputation for being uncooperative with outsiders, but Bruder's organization had significant influence. Police, consulates, embassies.
When we make demands, nobody dares question.
Bruder entered the small office where his man stood over an open laptop and typed in latex gloves. This is the machine he used, the man said. Langdon used it to access his email and run some searches. The files are still cached. Bruder moved toward the desk. It doesn't appear to be Langdon's computer, the tech said. It's registered to someone initialed S.C. I should have a full name shortly. As Bruder waited, his eyes were drawn to a stack of papers on the desk. He picked them up, thumbing through the unusual array, an old playbill from the London Globe Theater and a series of newspaper articles. The more Bruder read, the wider his eyes became. Taking the documents, Bruder slipped back into the hall and placed a call to his boss.
It's Bruder, he said. I think I've got an ID on the person helping Langdon.
Who is it? His boss replied. Bruder exhaled slowly.
You're not going to believe this.
2 miles away, Vientha hunkered low on her BMW as it fled the area. Police cars raced past her in the opposite direction, sirens blaring.
I've been disavowed, she thought.
Normally, the soft vibration of the motorcycle's four-stroke engine helped calm her nerves. Not today. Vientha had worked for the consortium for 12 years, climbing the ranks from ground support to strategy coordination, all the way to a high-ranked field agent.
My career is all I have.
Field agents endured a life of secrecy, travel, and long missions, all of which precluded any real outside life or relationships.
I've been on this same mission for a year, she thought,
still unable to believe the provost had pulled the trigger and disavowed her so abruptly. For 12 months, Vientha had been overseeing support services for the same client of the consortium, an eccentric, green-eyed genius who wanted only to disappear for a while so he could work unmolested by his rivals and enemies. He traveled very rarely and always invisibly, but mostly he worked. The nature of this man's work was not known to Vientha, whose contract had simply been to keep the client hidden from the powerful people trying to find him. Vientha had performed the service with consummate professionalism, and everything had gone perfectly. Perfectly, that was, until last night. Vientha's emotional state and career had been in a downward spiral ever since.
I'm on the outside now.
The disavowal protocol, if invoked, required that the agent instantly abandon her current mission and exit the arena at once. If the agent were captured, the consortium would disavow all knowledge of the agent. Agents knew better than to press their luck with the organization, having witnessed firsthand its disturbing ability to manipulate reality into whatever suited its needs. Vientha knew of only 2 agents who had been disavowed. Strangely, she had never seen either of them again. She had always assumed they had been called in for their formal review and fired, required never to make contact again with consortium employees. Now, however, Vientha was not so sure.
You're overreacting, she tried to tell herself. The consortium's methods are far more elegant than cold-blooded murder.
Even so, she felt a fresh chill sweep through her body. It had been instinct that urged her to flee the hotel rooftop unseen the moment she saw Bruder's team arrive, and she wondered if that instinct had saved her.
Nobody knows where I am now,
As Vayantha sped northward on the sleek straightaway of the Viale del Poggio Imperiale, she realized what a difference a few hours had made for her. Last night she had been worried about protecting her job. Now, she was worried about protecting her life. Chapter 20. Florence was once a walled city, its primary entrance the stone gateway of the Porta Romana, built in 1326. While most of the city's perimeter walls were destroyed centuries ago, the Porta Romana still exists, and to this day, traffic enters the city by funneling through deep arched tunnels in the colossal fortification. The gateway itself is a 50-foot tall barrier of ancient brick and stone, whose primary passageway still retains its massive bolted wooden doors, which are propped open at all times to let traffic pass through. Six major roads converge in front of these doors, filtering into a rotary whose grassy median is dominated by a large Pistoletto statue depicting a woman departing the city gates carrying an enormous bundle on her head. Although nowadays it is more of a snarled traffic nightmare, Florence's austere city gate was once the site of the Fiera dei Contratti, the contracts fair, at which fathers sold their daughters into a contracted marriage, often forcing them to dance provocatively in an effort to secure higher dowries. This morning, several hundred yards short of the gateway, Sienna had screeched to a stop and was now pointing in alarm. On the back of the trike, Langdon looked ahead and immediately shared her apprehension. In front of them, a long line of cars idled at a full stop. Traffic in the rotary had been halted by a police barricade, and more police cars were now arriving. Armed officers were walking from car to car, asking questions.
That can't be for us, Langdon thought. Can it?
A sweaty cyclist came pedaling toward them up the Viale Machiavelli, away from the traffic. He was on a recumbent bike, his bare legs pumping out in front of him. Sienna shouted out to him,
Cos'è successo?
E chi lo sa?
He shouted back, looking concerned.
Carabinieri!
He hurried past, looking eager to clear the area. Sienna turned to Langdon, her expression grim.
Roadblock. Military police.
Sirens wailed in the distance behind them, and Sienna spun in her seat, staring back up the Viale Machiavelli, her face now masked with fear.
We're trapped in the middle, Langdon thought, scanning the area for any exit at all, an intersecting road, a park, a driveway.
But all he saw were private residences on their left and a high stone wall to their right. The sirens grew louder.
Up there!
Langdon urged, pointing 30 yards ahead to a deserted construction site where a portable cement mixer offered at least a little bit of cover. Sienna gunned the bike up onto the sidewalk and raced into the work area. They parked behind the cement mixer, quickly realizing that it offered barely enough concealment for the trike alone.
Follow me,
Sienna said, rushing toward a small portable tool shed nestled in the bushes against the stone wall.
That's not a tool shed, Langdon realized, his nose crinkling as they got closer. That's a porta-potty.
As Langdon and Sienna arrived outside the construction worker's chemical toilet, they could hear police cars approaching from behind them. Sienna yanked the door handle, but it didn't budge. A heavy chain and padlock secured it. Langdon grabbed Sienna's arm and pulled her around behind the structure, forcing her into the narrow space between the toilet and the stone wall. The two of them barely fit, and the air smelled putrid and heavy. Langdon slid in behind her just as a jet-black Subaru Forester came into view with the word Carabinieri emblazoned on its side. The vehicle rolled slowly past their location.
The Italian military police, Langdon thought, incredulous.
He wondered if these officers also had orders to shoot on sight.
Someone is dead serious about finding us,
Sienna whispered,
and somehow they did.
GPS? Langdon wondered aloud. Maybe the projector has a tracking device in it. Sienna shook her head.
Believe me, if that thing were traceable, the police would be right on top of us.
Langdon shifted his tall frame, trying to get comfortable in the cramped surroundings. He found himself face to face with a collage of elegantly styled graffiti scrawled on the back of the porta-potty. Leave it to the Italians. Most American porta-potties were covered with sophomoric cartoons that vaguely resembled huge breasts or penises. The graffiti on this one, however, looked more like an art student's sketchbook. A human eye, a well-rendered hand, a man in profile, and a fantastical dragon.
Destruction of property doesn't look like this everywhere in Italy,
Sienna said, apparently reading his mind.
The Florence Art Institute is on the other side of this stone wall.
As if to confirm Sienna's statement, a group of students appeared in the distance, ambling toward them with art portfolios under their arms. They were chatting, lighting cigarettes, and puzzling over the roadblock in front of them at the Porta Romana. Langdon and Sienna crouched lower to stay out of sight of the students. And as they did so, Langdon was struck, most unexpectedly, by a curious thought. The half-buried sinners with their legs in the air. Perhaps it was on account of the smell of human waste, or possibly the recumbent bicyclist with bare legs flailing in front of him. But whatever the stimulus, Langdon had flashed on the putrid world of the Malabolge and the naked legs protruding upside down from the earth. He turned suddenly to his companion.
Sienna, in our version of La Mappa, the upside-down legs were in the 10th ditch, right? The lowest level of the Malabolge?
Sienna gave him an odd look, as if this were hardly the time.
Yes, at the bottom.
For a split second, Langdon was back in Vienna giving his lecture. He was standing on stage, only moments from his grand finale, having just shown the audience Doré's engraving of Geryon, the winged monster with a poisonous, stinging tail that lived just above the Malabolge. Before we meet Satan, Langdon declared, his deep voice resonating over the loudspeakers, we must pass through the 10 ditches of the Malabolge, in which are punished the fraudulent, those guilty of deliberate evil. Langdon advanced slides to show a detail of the Malabolge, and then took the audience down through the ditches one by one. From top to bottom we have the seducers, whipped by demons, the flatterers, adrift in human excrement, the clerical profiteers half-buried upside down with their legs in the air, the sorcerers with their heads twisted backward, the corrupt politicians in boiling pitch, the hypocrites wearing heavy leaden cloaks, the thieves bitten by snakes, the fraudulent counselors consumed by fire, the sowers of discord hacked apart by demons, and finally, the liars, who are diseased beyond recognition. Langdon turned back to the audience. Dante most likely reserved this final ditch for the liars because a series of lies told about him led to his exile from his beloved Florence.
Robert!
The voice was Sienna's. Langdon snapped back to the present. Sienna was staring at him quizzically.
What is it?
Our version of La Mappa, he said excitedly. The art has been changed. He fished the projector out of his jacket pocket and shook it as best as he could in the close quarters. The agitator ball rattled loudly, but all the sirens drowned it out. Whoever created this image reconfigured the order of the levels in the Malabolge. When the device began to glow, Langdon pointed it at the flat surface before them. La Mappa dell'Inferno appeared, glowing brightly in the dim light. Botticelli on a chemical toilet, Langdon thought, ashamed. This had to be the least elegant place a Botticelli had ever been displayed. Langdon ran his eyes down through the 10 ditches and began nodding excitedly.
Yes, he exclaimed. This is wrong. The last ditch of the Malabolge is supposed to be full of diseased people, not people upside down. The 10th level is for the liars, not the clerical profiteers.
Sienna looked intrigued.
But why would someone change that?
Quattrovasser, Langdon whispered, eyeing the little letters that had been added to each level. I don't think that's what this really says. Despite the injury that had erased Langdon's recollections of the last 2 days, he could now feel his memory working perfectly. He closed his eyes and held the two versions of La Mappa in his mind's eye to analyze their differences. The changes to the Malabolge were fewer than Langdon had imagined, and yet he felt like a veil had suddenly been lifted.
Suddenly, it was crystal clear. Seek and ye shall find.
What is it? Sienna demanded. Langdon's mouth felt dry. I know why I'm here in Florence.
You do?
Yes, and I know where I'm supposed to go. Sienna grabbed his arm.
Where?
Langdon felt as if his feet had just touched solid ground for the first time since he'd awoken in the hospital.
These 10 letters, he whispered.
They actually point to a precise location in the old city. That's where the answers are.
Where in the old city? Sienna demanded. What did you figure out?
The sounds of laughing voices echoed on the other side of the porta potty. Another group of art students was passing by, joking and chatting in various languages. Langdon peered cautiously around the cubicle, watching them go. Then he scanned for police.
We've got to keep moving. I'll explain on the way.
On the way?
Sienna shook her head.
We'll never get through the Porta Romana.
Stay here for 30 seconds, he told her, and then follow my lead.
With that, Langdon slipped away, leaving his newfound friend bewildered and alone. Chapter 21
Scusi!
Robert Langdon chased after the group of students.
Scusate!
They all turned, and Langdon made a show of glancing around like a lost tourist.
Dove l'Istituto Statale d'Arte?
Langdon asked in broken Italian. A tattooed kid puffed coolly on a cigarette and snidely replied,
Non parliamo italiano.
His accent was French. One of the girls admonished her tattooed friend and politely pointed down the long wall toward the Porta Romana.
Più avanti, sempre dritto.
Straight ahead, Langdon translated.
Grazie.
On cue, Sienna emerged unseen from behind the porta potty and walked over. The willowy 32-year-old approached the group and Langdon placed a welcoming hand on her shoulder.
This is my sister, Sienna. She's an art teacher.
The tattooed kid muttered,
T-I-L-F,
and his male friends laughed. Langdon ignored them. We're in Florence researching possible spots for a teaching year abroad. Can we walk in with you?
Ma certo,
the Italian girl said with a smile. As the group migrated toward the police at the Porta Romana, Sienna fell into conversation with the students while Langdon merged to the middle of the group, slouching low, trying to stay out of sight. Seek and ye shall find, Langdon thought, his pulse racing with excitement as he pictured the 10 ditches of the Malaborge. Quattrovasser. These 10 letters, Langdon had realized, stood at the core of one of the art world's most enigmatic mysteries, a centuries-old puzzle that had never been solved. In 1563, these 10 letters had been used to spell a message high on a wall inside Florence's famed Palazzo Vecchio, painted some 40 feet off the ground, barely visible without binoculars. It had remained hidden there in plain sight for centuries, until the 1970s, when it was spotted by a now-famous art diagnostician who had spent decades trying to uncover its meaning. Despite numerous theories, the significance of the message remains an enigma to this day. For Langdon, the code felt like familiar ground, a safe harbor from this strange and churning sea. After all, art history and ancient secrets were far more Langdon's realm than were biohazard tubes and gunfire. Up ahead, additional police cars had begun streaming in to Porta Romana.
Jesus, the tattooed kid said. Whoever they are looking for must have done something terrible.
The group arrived at the Art Institute's main gate on the right, where a crowd of students had gathered to watch the action at the Porta Romana. The school's minimum wage security guard was half-heartedly glancing at student IDs as kids streamed in, but he was clearly more interested in what was happening with the police. A loud screech of brakes echoed across the plaza as an all-too-familiar black van skidded into the Porta Romana. Langdon didn't need a second look. Without a word, he and Sienna seized the moment, slipping through the gate with their new friends. The entry road to the Istituto Statale d'Arte was startlingly beautiful, almost regal in appearance. Massive oak trees arched gently in from either side, creating a canopy that framed the distant building, a huge, faded yellow structure with a triple portico and an expansive oval lawn. This building, Langdon knew, had been commissioned, like so many in this city, by the same illustrious dynasty that had dominated Florentine politics during the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries. The Medici. The name alone had become a symbol of Florence. During its 3-century reign, the royal house of Medici amassed unfathomable wealth and influence, producing 4 popes, 2 queens of France, and the largest financial institution in all of Europe. To this day, modern banks use the accounting method invented by the Medici, the dual entry system of credits and debits. The Medici's greatest legacy, however, was not in finance or politics, but rather in art. Perhaps the most lavish patrons the art world has ever known, the Medici provided a generous stream of commissions that fueled the Renaissance. The list of luminaries receiving Medici patronage ranged from Da Vinci to Galileo to Botticelli. The latter's most famous painting, Birth of Venus, the result of a commission from Lorenzo de' Medici, who requested a sexually provocative painting to hang over his cousin's marital bed as a wedding gift. Lorenzo de' Medici, known in his day as Lorenzo the Magnificent on account of his benevolence, was an accomplished artist and poet in his own right, and was said to have a superb eye. In 1489, Lorenzo took a liking to the work of a young Florentine sculptor and invited the boy to move into the Medici Palace, where he could practice his craft surrounded by fine art, great poetry, and high culture. Under Medici tutelage, the adolescent boy flourished and eventually went on to carve two of the most celebrated sculptures in all of history, the Pietà and the David. Today we know him as Michelangelo, a creative giant who is sometimes called the Medici's greatest gift to humankind. Considering the Medici's passion for art, Langdon imagined the family would be pleased to know that the building before him, originally built as the Medici's primary horse stables, had been transformed into the vibrant Art Institute. This tranquil site that now inspired young artists had been specifically chosen for the Medici's stables because of its proximity to one of the most beautiful riding areas in all of Florence, the Boboli Gardens. Langdon glanced to his left, where a forest of treetops could be seen over a high wall. The massive expanse of the Boboli Gardens was now a popular tourist attraction. Langdon had little doubt that if he and Sienna could gain entrance to the gardens, they could make their way across it, bypassing the Porta Romana undetected. After all, the gardens were vast and had no shortage of hiding places. Forests, labyrinths, grottos, nymphaea. More important, traversing the Boboli Gardens would eventually lead them to the Palazzo Pitti, the stone citadel that once housed the main seat of the Medici Grand Duchy, and whose 140 rooms remained one of Florence's most frequented tourist attractions. If we can reach the Palazzo Pitti, Langdon thought, the bridge to the old city is a stone's throw away. Langdon motioned as calmly as possible to the high wall that enclosed the gardens. How do we get into the gardens? He asked. I'd love to show my sister before we tour the institute. The tattooed kid shook his head.
You can't get into the gardens from here. The entrance is way over at Pitti Palace. You'd have to drive through Porta Romana and go around.
Bullshit, Sienna blurted.
Everyone turned and stared at her, including Langdon.
Come on,
she said, smirking coyly at the students as she stroked her blonde ponytail.
You're telling me you guys don't sneak into the gardens to smoke weed and fool around?
The kids all exchanged looks and then burst out laughing. The guy with the tattoos now looked utterly smitten.
Ma'am, you should totally teach here.
He walked Sienna to the side of the building and pointed around the corner to a rear parking lot.
See that shed on the left? There's an old platform behind it. Climb up on the roof, and you can jump down on the other side of the wall.
Sienna was already on the move. She glanced back at Langdon with a patronizing smile.
Come on, Brother Bob. Unless you're too old to jump a fence.
Chapter 22. The silver-haired woman in the van leaned her head against the bulletproof window and closed her eyes. She felt like the world was spinning beneath her. The drugs they'd given her made her feel ill.
I need medical attention, she thought.
Even so, the armed guard beside her had strict orders. Her needs were to be ignored until their task had been successfully completed. From the sounds of chaos around her, it was clear that would be no time soon. The dizziness was increasing now, and she was having trouble breathing. As she fought off a new wave of nausea, she wondered how life had managed to deliver her to this surreal crossroads. The answer was too complex to decipher in her current delirious state, but she had no doubt where it had all begun.
New York, 2 years ago.
She had flown to Manhattan from Geneva, where she was serving as the director of the World Health Organization, a highly coveted and prestigious post that she had held for nearly a decade. A specialist in communicable disease and the epidemiology of epidemics, she had been invited to the UN to deliver a lecture assessing the threat of pandemic disease in third world countries. Her talk had been upbeat and reassuring, outlining several new early detection systems and treatment plans devised by the World Health Organization and others. She had received a standing ovation. Following the lecture, while she was in the hall talking to some lingering academics, a UN employee with a high-level diplomatic badge strode over and interrupted the conversation.
Dr. Sinsky,
we have just been contacted by the Council on Foreign Relations. There is someone there who would like to speak to you. A car is waiting outside. Puzzled and a bit unnerved, Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky excused herself and collected her overnight bag. As her limo raced up First Avenue, she began to feel strangely nervous.
The Council on Foreign Relations?
Elizabeth Sinsky, like most, had heard the rumors. Founded in the 1920s as a private think tank, the CFR had among its past membership nearly every Secretary of State, more than a half dozen presidents, a majority of CIA chiefs, senators, judges, as well as dynastic legends with names like Morgan, Rothschild, and Rockefeller. The membership's unparalleled collection of brain power, political influence, and wealth had earned the Council on Foreign Relations the reputation of being the most influential private club on earth. As director of the World Health Organization, Elizabeth was no stranger to rubbing shoulders with the big boys. Her long tenure at WHO, combined with her outspoken nature, had earned her a nod recently from a major news magazine that listed her among its 20 most influential people in the world. The face of world health, they had written beneath her photo, which Elizabeth found ironic, considering she had been such a sick child. Suffering from severe asthma by age 6, she had been treated with a high dose of a promising new drug, the first of the world's glucocorticoids, or steroid hormones, which had cured her asthma symptoms in miraculous fashion. Sadly, the drug's unanticipated side effects had not emerged until years later when Sinsky passed through puberty and yet never developed a menstrual cycle. She would never forget the dark moment in the doctor's office at 19 when she learned that the damage to her reproductive system was permanent. Elizabeth Sinsky could never have children.
Time will heal the emptiness, her doctor assured,
but the sadness and anger only grew inside her. Cruelly, the drugs that had robbed her of her ability to conceive a child had failed to rob her of her animal instincts to do so. For decades, she had battled her cravings to fulfill this impossible desire. Even now, at 61 years old, she still felt a pang of hollowness every time she saw a mother and infant. It's just ahead, Dr. Sinsky, the limo driver announced. Elizabeth ran a quick brush through her long silver ringlets and checked her face in the mirror. Before she knew it, the car had stopped, and the driver was helping her out onto the sidewalk in an affluent section of Manhattan. I'll wait here for you, the driver said. We can go straight to the airport when you're ready. The New York headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations was an unobtrusive neoclassical building on the corner of Park and 68th that had once been the home of a Standard Oil tycoon. Its exterior blended seamlessly with the elegant landscape surrounding it, offering no hint of its unique purpose.
Dr. Sinsky, a portly female receptionist greeted her. This way, please. He's expecting you.
Okay, but who is he? She followed the receptionist down a luxurious corridor to a closed door, on which the woman gave a quick knock before opening it and motioning for Elizabeth to enter. She went in, and the door closed behind her. The small, dark conference room was illuminated only by the glow of a video screen. In front of the screen, a very tall and lanky silhouette faced her. Though she couldn't make out his face, she sensed power here.
Dr. Sinsky,
the man's sharp voice declared. Thank you for joining me. The man's tautly precise accent suggested Elizabeth's homeland of Switzerland, or perhaps Germany.
Please sit,
he said, motioning to a chair near the front of the room.
No introductions?
Elizabeth sat. The bizarre image being projected on the video screen did nothing to calm her nerves.
What in the world?
I was at your presentation this morning, declared the silhouette. I came a long distance to hear you speak. An impressive performance.
Thank you, she replied.
Might I also say you are much more beautiful than I imagined, despite your age and your myopic view of world health.
Elizabeth felt her jaw drop. The comment was offensive in all kinds of ways.
Excuse me? She demanded, peering into the darkness. Who are you, and why have you called me here?
Pardon my failed attempt at humor, the lanky shadow replied. The image on the screen will explain why you're here.
Sinsky eyed the horrific visual. A painting depicting a vast sea of humanity. Throngs of sickly people, all climbing over one another in a dense tangle of naked bodies.
The great artist Doré, the man announced. His spectacularly grim interpretation of Dante Alighieri's vision of hell. I hope it looks comfortable to you, because that's where we're headed.
He paused, drifting slowly toward her. And let me tell you why. He kept moving toward her, seeming to grow taller with every step.
If I were to take this piece of paper and tear it in two.
He paused at a table, picked up a sheet of paper, and ripped it loudly in half.
And then, if I were to place the two halves on top of each other,
he stacked the two halves.
And then, if I were to repeat the process,
he again tore the papers, stacking them.
I produce a stack of paper that is now four times the thickness of the original. Correct?
His eyes seemed to smolder in the darkness of the room. Elizabeth did not appreciate his condescending tone and aggressive posture. She said nothing.
Hypothetically speaking, he continued, moving closer still, if the original sheet of paper is a mere 1/10 of a millimeter thick, and I were to repeat this process, say, 50 times, do you know how tall this stack would be?
Elizabeth bristled.
I do,
she replied with more hostility than she intended.
It would be 1/10 of a millimeter times 2 to the 50th power. It's called geometric progression. Might I ask what I'm doing here?
The man smirked and gave an impressed nod.
Yes, and can you guess what the actual value might look like? 1/10 of a millimeter times 2 to the 50th power? Do you know how tall our stack of paper has become?
He paused only an instant.
Our stack of paper, after only 50 doublings, now reaches almost all the way to the sun.
Elizabeth was not surprised. The staggering power of geometric growth was something she dealt with all the time in her work.
Circles of contamination, replication of infected cells, death toll estimates. I apologize if I seem naive, she said, making no effort to hide her annoyance, but I'm missing your point.
My point? He chuckled quietly. My point is that the history of our human population growth is even more dramatic. The Earth's population, like our stack of paper, had very meager beginnings, but alarming potential.
He was pacing again.
Consider this. It took the Earth's population thousands of years, from the early dawn of man all the way to the early 1800s, to reach 1 billion people. Then, astoundingly, it took only about 100 years to double the population to 2 billion in the 1920s. After that, it took a mere 50 years for the population to double again to 4 billion in the 1970s. As you can imagine, we're well on track to reach 8 billion very soon. Just today, the human race added another 250,000 people to planet Earth. 250,000. And this happens every day, rain or shine. Currently, every year, we're adding the equivalent of the entire country of Germany.
The tall man stopped short, hovering over Elizabeth.
How old are you?
Another offensive question, although as the head of the WHO, she was accustomed to handling antagonism with diplomacy.
61.
Did you know that if you live another 19 years until the age of 80, you will witness the population triple in your lifetime? One lifetime, a tripling. Think of the implications. As you know, your World Health Organization has again increased its forecasts, predicting there will be some 9 billion people on Earth before the midpoint of this century. Animal species are going extinct at a precipitously accelerated rate. The demand for dwindling natural resources is skyrocketing. Clean water is harder and harder to come by. By any biological gauge, our species has exceeded our sustainable numbers. And in the face of this disaster, the World Health Organization, the gatekeeper of the planet's health, is investing in things like curing diabetes, filling blood banks, battling cancer.
He paused, staring directly at her.
And so I brought you here to ask you directly why the hell the World Health Organization does not have the guts to deal with this issue head on.
Elizabeth was seething now.
Whoever you are, you know damned well the WHO takes overpopulation very seriously. Recently we spent millions of dollars sending doctors into Africa to deliver free condoms and educate people about birth control.
Ah, yes, the lanky man derided. And an even bigger army of Catholic missionaries marched in on your heels and told the Africans that if they used the condoms, they'd all go to hell. Africa has a new environmental issue now. Landfills overflowing with unused condoms.
Elizabeth strained to hold her tongue. He was correct on this point, and yet modern Catholics were starting to fight back against the Vatican's meddling in reproductive issues. Most notably, Melinda Gates, a devout Catholic herself, had bravely risked the wrath of her own church by pledging $560 million to help improve access to birth control around the world. Elizabeth Sinsky had gone on record many times saying that Bill and Melinda Gates deserved to be canonized for all they'd done through their foundation to improve world health. Sadly, the only institution capable of conferring sainthood somehow failed to see the Christian nature of their efforts.
Dr. Sinsky, the shadow continued, what the World Health Organization fails to recognize is that there is only one global health issue.
He pointed again to the grim image on the screen, a sea of tangled, cloying humanity.
And this is it.
He paused.
I realize you are a scientist, and therefore perhaps not a student of the classics or the fine arts. So let me offer another image that may speak to you in a language you can better understand.
The room went dark for an instant, and the screen refreshed. The new image was one Elizabeth had seen many times. A graph depicting the alarming growth of population in recent years. And it always brought an eerie sense of inevitability. A heavy silence settled in the room.
Yes, the lanky man finally said. Silent terror is an apt response to this graph. Seeing it is a bit like staring into the headlight of an oncoming locomotive.
Slowly, the man turned to Elizabeth and gave her a tight, condescending smile.
Any questions, Dr. Sinsky?
Just one, she fired back. Did you bring me here to lecture me or insult me?
Neither.
His voice turned eerily cajoling.
I brought you here to work with you. I have no doubt you understand that overpopulation is a health issue, but what I fear you don't understand is that it will affect the very soul of man. Under the stress of overpopulation, those who have never considered stealing will become thieves to feed their families. Those who have never considered killing will kill to provide for their young. All of Dante's deadly sins, greed, gluttony, treachery, murder, and the rest will begin percolating, rising up to the surface of humanity, amplified,
by our evaporating comforts. We are facing a battle for the very soul of man. I'm a biologist. I save lives, not souls.
Well, I can assure you that saving lives will become increasingly difficult in the coming years. Overpopulation breeds far more than spiritual discontent. There is a passage in Machiavelli.
Yes, she interrupted, reciting her recollection of the famous quote. When every province of the world so teems with inhabitants that they can neither subsist where they are, nor remove themselves elsewhere, the world will purge itself. She stared up at him. All of us at the WHO are familiar with that quotation.
Good. Then you know that Machiavelli went on to talk about plagues as the world's natural way of self-purging.
Yes, and as I mentioned in my talk, we are well aware of the direct correlation between population density and the likelihood of wide-scale epidemics, but we are constantly devising new detection and treatment methods. The WHO remains confident that we can prevent future pandemics.
That's a pity. Elizabeth stared in disbelief.
I beg your pardon?
Dr. Sinsky, the man said with a strange laugh. You talk about controlling epidemics as if it's a good thing. She gaped up at the man in mute disbelief. There you have it, the lanky man declared, sounding like an attorney resting his case. Here I stand with the head of the World Health Organization, the best the WHO has to offer. A terrifying thought if you consider it. I have shown you this image of impending misery. He refreshed the screen again, displaying the image of the bodies. I have reminded you of the awesome power of unchecked population growth. He pointed to his small stack of paper. I have enlightened you about the fact that we are on the brink of a spiritual collapse. He paused and turned directly toward her. And your response? Free condoms in Africa. The man gave a derisive sneer. This is like swinging a fly swatter at an incoming asteroid. The time bomb is no longer ticking. It has already gone off. And without drastic measures, exponential mathematics will become your new god. And he is a vengeful god. He will bring to you Dante's vision of hell right outside on Park Avenue. Huddled masses wallowing in their own excrement. A global culling orchestrated by nature herself.
Is that so? Elizabeth snapped. So tell me, in your vision of a sustainable future, what is the ideal population of Earth? What is the magic number at which humankind can hope to sustain itself indefinitely and in relative comfort?
The tall man smiled, clearly appreciating the question.
Any environmental biologist or statistician will tell you that humankind's best chance of long-term survival occurs with a global population of around 4 billion.
4 billion? Elizabeth fired back. We're at 7 billion now, so it's a little late for that.
The tall man's green eyes flashed fire.
Is it?
Chapter 23. Robert Langdon landed hard on the spongy earth just inside the retaining wall of the Bubbly Garden's heavily wooded southern edge. Sienna landed beside him and stood up, brushing herself off and taking in their surroundings. They were standing in a glade of moss and ferns on the edge of a small forest. From here, the Palazzo Pitti was entirely obscured from view, and Langdon sensed they were about as far from the palace as one could get in the gardens. At least there were no workers or tourists out this far at this early hour. Langdon gazed at a peystone pathway that wound gracefully downhill into the forest before them. At the point where the path disappeared into the trees, a marble statue had been perfectly situated to receive the eye. Langdon was not surprised. The Boboli Gardens had enjoyed the exceptional design talents of Niccolò Tribolo, Giorgio Vasari, and Bernardo Buontalenti, a brain trust of aesthetic talent that had created on this 111-acre canvas a walkable masterpiece. If we head northeast, we'll reach the palace, Langdon said, pointing down the path. We can mix there with the tourists and exit unseen. I'm guessing it opens at 9. Langdon glanced down to check the time, but saw only his bare wrist where his Mickey Mouse watch had once been strapped. He wondered absently if it was still at the hospital with the rest of his clothing, and if he'd ever be able to retrieve it. Sienna planted her feet defiantly.
Robert, before we take another step, I want to know where we're going. What did you figure out back there? The Malebolger? You said it was out of sequence?
Langdon motioned toward a wooded area just ahead. Let's get out of sight first. He led her down a pathway that curled into an enclosed hollow, a room in the parlance of landscape architecture, where there were some faux bois benches and a small fountain. The air beneath the trees was decidedly colder. Langdon took the projector from his pocket and began shaking it. Sienna, whoever created this digital image not only added letters to the sinners in the Malebolge, but he also changed the order of the sins. He hopped up on the bench, towering over Sienna, and aimed the projector down at his feet. Botticelli's Mappo dell'Inferno materialized faintly on the flat benchtop beside Sienna. Langdon motioned to the tiered area at the bottom of the funnel. See the letters in the 10 ditches of the Malebolge? Sienna found them on the projection and read from top to bottom.
Katrovasser.
Right. Meaningless.
But then you realized the 10 ditches had been shuffled around?
Easier than that, actually. If these levels were a deck of 10 cards, the deck was not so much shuffled as simply cut once. After the cut, the cards remain in the correct order, but they start with the wrong card. Langdon pointed down at the 10 ditches of the Malebolge. According to Dante's text, our top level should be the seducers whipped by demons. And yet in this version, the seducers appear way down in the 7th ditch. Sienna studied the now fading image beside her and nodded.
Okay, I see that. The 1st ditch is now the 7th.
Langdon pocketed the projector and jumped back down onto the pathway. He grabbed a small stick and began scratching letters on a patch of dirt just off the path. Here are the letters as they appear in our modified version of hell. Langdon read down the list. C-A-T-R-O-V-A-C-E-R.
Katrovasser, Sienna read.
Yes. And here is where the deck was cut. Langdon now drew a line beneath the 7th letter and waited while Sienna studied his handiwork.
Okay, she said quickly. Katrova, Ser.
Yes, and to put the cards back in order, we simply uncut the deck and place the bottom on top. The two halves swap places. Sienna eyed the letters.
Ser, Katrova.
She shrugged, looking unimpressed.
Still meaningless.
Ser Katrova, Langdon repeated. After a pause, he said the words again, eliding them together. Ser Katrova. Finally, he said them with a pause in the middle. Cherka Trova. Sienna gasped audibly, and her eyes shot up to meet Langdon's. Yes, Langdon said with a smile. Cherka Trova. The two Italian words, cerca and trova, literally meant seek and find. When combined as a phrase, cerca trova, they were synonymous with the biblical aphorism, seek and ye shall find.
Your hallucinations, Sienna exclaimed, breathless. The woman with the veil, she kept telling you to seek and find.
She jumped to her feet.
Robert, do you realize what this means? It means the words cerca, trova, were already in your subconscious. Don't you see? You must have deciphered this phrase before you arrived at the hospital. You had probably seen this projector's image already, but had forgotten.
She's right, he realized, having been so fixated on the cipher itself that it never occurred to him that he might have been through all of this already.
Robert, you said earlier that La Mappa points to a specific location in the old city, but I still don't understand where.
Cerca Trova doesn't ring any bells for you? She shrugged. Langdon smiled inwardly. Finally, something Sienna doesn't know. As it turns out, this phrase points very specifically to a famous mural that hangs in the Palazzo Vecchio, Giorgio Vasari's Battaglia di Marciano, in the Hall of the 500. Near the top of the painting, barely visible, Vasari painted the words Cerca Trova in tiny letters. Plenty of theories exist as to why he did this, but no conclusive proof has ever been discovered. The high-pitched whine of a small aircraft suddenly buzzed overhead, streaking in out of nowhere and skimming the wooded canopy just above them. The sound was very close, and Langdon and Sienna froze as the craft raced past. As the aircraft departed, Langdon peered up at it through the trees. "Toy helicopter," he said, exhaling as he watched the 3-foot-long radio-controlled chopper banking in the distance. It sounded like a giant, angry mosquito. Sienna, however, still looked wary.
"Stay down."
Sure enough, the little chopper banked fully and was now coming back their way, skimming the treetops, sailing past them again, this time off to their left above another glade.
"That's not a toy," she whispered. "It's a reconnaissance drone. Probably has a video camera on board sending live images back to somebody."
Langdon's jaw tightened as he watched the chopper streak off in the direction from which it had appeared, the Porta Romana and the Art Institute.
"I don't know what you did," Sienna said, "but some powerful people are clearly very eager to find you."
The helicopter banked yet again and began a slow pass along the perimeter wall they had just jumped.
"Someone at the Art Institute must have seen us and said something," Sienna said, heading down the path. "We've got to get out of here now."
As the drone buzzed away toward the far end of the gardens, Langdon used his foot to erase the letters he'd written on the pathway and then hurried after Sienna. His mind swirled with thoughts of Cerca Trova, the Giorgio Vasari mural, as well as with Sienna's revelation that Langdon must have already deciphered the projector's message. "Seek and ye shall find." Suddenly, just as they entered a second glade, a startling thought hit Langdon. He skidded to a stop on the wooded path, a bemused look on his face. Sienna stopped, too.
"Robert, what is it?"
"I'm innocent," he declared.
"What are you talking about?"
"The people chasing me. I assumed it was because I had done something terrible."
"Yes, at the hospital you kept repeating, very sorry."
"I know, but I thought I was speaking English."
Sienna looked at him with surprise.
"You were speaking English."
Langdon's blue eyes were now filled with excitement.
"Sienna, when I kept saying very sorry, I wasn't apologizing. I was mumbling about the secret message in the mural at Palazzo Vecchio." He could still hear the recording of his own delirious voice.
"Beh, sorry. Beh, sorry."
Sienna looked lost.
"Don't you see?" Langdon was grinning now. "I wasn't saying very sorry, very sorry. I was saying the artist's name. Vasari. Vasari."
Chapter 24. Bientha hit the brakes hard. Her motorcycle fishtailed, screeching loudly as it left a long skid mark on the Viale del Poggio Imperiale, finally coming to an abrupt stop behind an unexpected line of traffic. The Viale del Poggio was at a standstill.
"I don't have time for this."
Bientha craned her neck over the cars, trying to see what was causing the holdup. She had already been forced to drive in a wide circle to avoid the SRS team and all the chaos at the apartment building, and now she needed to get into the old city to clear out of the hotel room where she had been stationed for the last few days of this mission.
"I've been disavowed. I need to get the hell out of town."
Her string of bad luck, however, seemed to be continuing. The route she had selected into the old city appeared to be blocked. In no mood to wait, Bientha revved the bike off to one side of the traffic and sped along the narrow breakdown lane until she could see the snarled intersection. Up ahead was a clogged rotary where 6 major thoroughfares converged. This was the Porta Romana, one of Florence's most trafficked intersections, the gateway to the old city.
"What the hell is going on here?"
Bayantha now saw that the entire area was swarming with police, a roadblock or checkpoint of some sort. Moments later, she spotted something at the center of the action that left her baffled. A familiar black van around which several black-clad agents were calling out orders to the local authorities. These men, without a doubt, were members of the SRS team. And yet, Bayantha could not imagine what they were doing here.
Unless...
Bayantha swallowed hard, scarcely daring to imagine the possibility.
Has Langdon eluded Bruder as well?
It seemed unthinkable. The chances of escape had been near zero. Then again, Langdon was not working alone, and Bayantha had experienced firsthand how resourceful the blonde woman could be. Nearby, a police officer appeared, walking from car to car, showing a photo of a handsome man with thick brown hair. Bayantha instantly recognized the photo as a press shot of Robert Langdon. Her heart soared.
Bruder missed him. Langdon is still in play.
An experienced strategist, Bayantha immediately began assessing how this development changed her situation.
Option one, flee as required.
Bayantha had blown a critical job for the provost and had been disavowed because of it. If she were lucky, she would face a formal inquiry and probable career termination. If, however, she were unlucky and had underestimated the severity of her employer, she might spend the rest of her life looking over her shoulder and wondering if the consortium was lurking just out of sight.
There is a second option now. Complete your mission.
Staying on task was in direct opposition to her disavowal protocol, and yet, with Langdon still on the run, Bayantha now had the opportunity to continue with her original directive.
If Bruder fails to catch Langdon, she thought, her pulse quickening, and if I succeed...
Bayantha knew it was a long shot, but if Langdon managed to elude Bruder entirely, and if Bayantha could still step in and finish the job, she would single-handedly have saved the day for the consortium, and the provost would have no choice but to be lenient.
I'll keep my job, she thought. Probably even be promoted.
In a flash, Bayantha realized that her entire future now revolved around a single critical undertaking.
I must locate Langdon before Bruder does.
It would not be easy. Bruder had at his disposal endless manpower as well as a vast array of advanced surveillance technologies. Bayantha was working alone. She did, however, possess one piece of information that Bruder, the provost, and the police did not have.
I have a very good idea where Langdon will go.
Revving the throttle on her BMW, she spun it 180 degrees around and headed back the way she came.
Ponte alla Grazie,
she thought, picturing the bridge to the north. There existed more than one route into the old city. Chapter 25. Not an apology, Langdon mused. An artist's name.
Vasari?
Sienna stammered, taking a full step backward on the path.
The artist who hid the words Cerca Trova in his mural.
Langdon couldn't help but smile. Vasari. Vasari. In addition to shedding a ray of light on his strange predicament, this revelation also meant Langdon was no longer wondering what terrible thing he might have done, for which he had been profusely saying he was very sorry.
Robert, you clearly had seen this Botticelli image on the projector before you were injured, and you knew it contained a code that pointed to Vasari's mural. That's why you woke up and kept repeating Vasari's name.
Langdon tried to calculate what all of this meant. Giorgio Vasari, a 16th century artist, architect, and writer, was a man Langdon often referred to as the world's first art historian. Despite the hundreds of paintings Vasari created and the dozens of buildings he designed, his most enduring legacy was his seminal book, Lives of the Most Excellent Painters, Sculptors, and Architects, a collection of biographies of Italian artists, which to this day remains requisite reading for students of art history. The words Cerca Trova had placed Vasari back in the mainstream consciousness about 30 years ago, when his secret message was discovered high on his sprawling mural in the Palazzo Vecchio's Hall of the 500. The tiny letters appeared on a green battle flag, barely visible among the chaos of the war scene. While consensus had yet to be reached as to why Vasari added this strange message to his mural, the leading theory was that it was a clue to future generations of the existence of a lost Leonardo da Vinci fresco hidden in a 3-centimeter gap behind that wall. Sienna was glancing nervously up through the trees.
There's still one thing I don't understand. If you weren't saying very sorry, then why are people trying to kill you?
Langdon had been wondering the same thing. The distant buzz of the surveillance drone was getting louder again, and Langdon knew the time had come for a decision. He failed to see how Vasari's Battaglia di Marciano could possibly relate to Dante's Inferno, or the gunshot wound he had suffered the night before. And yet he finally saw a tangible path before him. Cerca trova. Seek and find. Again, Langdon saw the silver-haired woman calling out to him from across the river. Time is running out. If there were answers, Langdon sensed they would be at the Palazzo Vecchio. He now flashed on an old adage from early Grecian freedivers who hunted lobsters in the coral caves of the Aegean Islands. When swimming into a dark tunnel, there arrives a point of no return when you no longer have enough breath to double back. Your only choice is to swim forward into the unknown and pray for an exit. Langdon wondered if they had reached that point. He eyed the maze of garden pathways before them. If he and Sienna could reach the Pitti Palace and exit the gardens, then the old city was just a short walk across the most famous footbridge in the world, the Ponte Vecchio. It was always crowded and would provide good cover. From there, the Palazzo Vecchio was only a few blocks away. The drone hummed closer now, and Langdon felt momentarily overwhelmed by exhaustion. The realization that he had not been saying very sorry left him feeling conflicted about running from the police. "Eventually they're going to catch me, Sienna," Langdon said. "It might be better for me to stop running." Sienna looked at him with alarm.
"Robert, every time you stop, someone starts shooting at you. You need to figure out what you're involved in. You need to look at that Vasari mural and hope it jars your memory. Maybe it will help you learn where this projector came from and why you're carrying it."
Langdon pictured the spike-haired woman coldly killing Dr. Marconi, the soldiers firing on them, the Italian military police gathering at the Porta Romana, and now a surveillance drone tracking them through the bubbly gardens. He fell silent, rubbing his tired eyes as he considered his options.
"Robert?"
Sienna's voice rose.
"There's one other thing. Something that didn't seem important, but now seems like it might be."
Langdon raised his eyes, reacting to the gravity in her tone.
"I intended to tell you at the apartment," she said. "But..."
"What is it?" Sienna pursed her lips, looking uncomfortable.
"When you arrived at the hospital, you were delirious and trying to communicate."
"Yes," Langdon said, mumbling Vasari, Vasari.
"Yes, but before that, before we got out the recorder, in the first moments after you arrived, you said one other thing I remember. You only said it once, but I'm positive I understood."
"What did I say?" Sienna glanced up toward the drone, and then back at Langdon.
"You said, 'I hold the key to finding it. If I fail, then all is death.'"
Langdon could only stare. Sienna continued,
"I thought you were referring to the object in your jacket pocket, but now I'm not so sure."
"If I fail, then all is death?" The words hit Langdon hard. The haunting images of death flickered before him. Dante's Inferno, the biohazard symbol, the plague doctor. Yet again, the face of the beautiful silver-haired woman pleaded with him across the blood-red river.
"Seek and find. Time is running out."
Sienna's voice pulled him back.
"Whatever this projector ultimately points to, or whatever you're trying to find, it must be something extremely dangerous. The fact that people are trying to kill us."
Her voice cracked slightly, and she took a moment to regroup.
"Think about it," They just shot at you in broad daylight. Shot at me, an innocent bystander. Nobody seems to be looking to negotiate. Your own government turned on you. You called them for help, and they sent someone to kill you.
Langdon stared vacantly at the ground. Whether the U.S. consulate had shared Langdon's location with the assassin, or whether the consulate itself had sent the assassin, was irrelevant. The upshot was the same. My own government is not on my side. Langdon looked into Sienna's brown eyes and saw bravery there. What have I gotten her involved in? I wish I knew what we were looking for. That would help put all of this into perspective. Sienna nodded.
Whatever it is, I think we need to find it. At least it would give us leverage.
Her logic was hard to refute. Still, Langdon felt something nagging at him.
If I fail, then all is death.
All morning he'd been running up against macabre symbols of biohazards, plagues, and Dante's hell. Admittedly, he had no clear proof of what he was looking for. But he would be naive not to consider at least the possibility that this situation involved a deadly disease or large-scale biological threat. But if this were true, why would his own government be trying to eliminate him? Do they think I'm somehow involved in a potential attack? It made no sense at all. There was something else going on here. Langdon thought again of the silver-haired woman. There's also the woman from my visions. I feel I need to find her.
Then trust your feelings, Sienna said. In your condition, the best compass you have is your subconscious mind. It's basic psychology. If your gut is telling you to trust that woman, then I think you should do exactly what she keeps telling you to do.
Seek and find, they said in unison. Langdon exhaled, knowing his path was clear.
All I can do is keep swimming down this tunnel.
With hardening resolve, he turned and began taking in his surroundings, trying to get his bearings.
Which way out of the gardens?
They were standing beneath the trees at the edge of a wide-open plaza where several paths intersected. In the distance to their left, Langdon spied an elliptical-shaped lagoon with a small island adorned with lemon trees and statuary.
The Isolotto,
he thought, recognizing the famous sculpture of Perseus on a half-submerged horse bounding through the water. The Pitti Palace is that way, Langdon said, pointing east, away from the Isolotto, toward the garden's main thoroughfare, the Viottolone, which ran east-west along the entire length of the grounds. The Viottolone was as wide as a two-lane road and lined by a row of slender, 400-year-old cypress trees.
There's no cover,
Sienna said, eyeing the uncamouflaged avenue and motioning up at the circling drone.
You're right, Langdon said with a lopsided grin,
which is why we're taking the tunnel beside it. He pointed again, this time to a dense hedgerow adjacent to the mouth of the Viottolone. The wall of dense greenery had a small arched opening cut into it. Beyond the opening, a slender footpath stretched out into the distance. A tunnel running parallel with the Viottolone. It was enclosed on either side by a phalanx of pruned holm oaks, which had been carefully trained since the 1600s to arch inward over the path, intertwining overhead and providing an awning of foliage. The pathway's name, La Cerchiata, literally circular or hooped, derived from its canopy of curved trees, resembling barrel stays or cerchi. Sienna hurried over to the opening and peered into the shaded channel. Immediately she turned back to him with a smile.
Better.
Wasting no time, she slipped through the opening and hurried off among the trees. Langdon had always considered La Cerchiata one of Florence's most peaceful spots. Today, however, as he watched Sienna disappear down the darkened allée, he thought again of the Grecian freedivers swimming into coral tunnels and praying they'd reach an exit. Langdon quickly said his own little prayer and hurried after her. A half mile behind them, outside the Art Institute, Agent Bruder strode through a bustle of police and students, his icy gaze parting the crowds before him. He made his way to the makeshift command post that his surveillance specialist had set up on the hood of his black van. From the aerial drone, the specialist said, handing Bruder a tablet screen. Taken a few minutes ago. Bruder examined the video stills, pausing on a blurry enlargement of two faces. A dark-haired man and a blonde, ponytailed woman, both huddled in the shadows and peering skyward through a canopy of trees. Robert Langdon, Sienna Brooks. Zero doubt. Bruder turned his attention to the map of the bubbly gardens, which was spread out on the hood. They made a poor choice, he thought, eyeing the garden layout. While it was sprawling and intricate, with plenty of hiding places, the gardens also appeared to be surrounded on all sides by high walls. The bubbly gardens were the closest thing to a natural kill box that Bruder had ever seen in the field. They'll never get out. Local authorities are sealing all exits, the agent said, and commencing a sweep. Keep me informed, Bruder said. Slowly, he raised his eyes to the van's thick polycarbonate window, beyond which he could see the silver-haired woman seated in the back of the vehicle. The drugs they had given her had definitely dulled her senses, more than Bruder had imagined. Nonetheless, he could tell by the fearful look in her eyes that she still had a firm grasp on precisely what was going on. She does not look happy, Bruder thought. Then again, why would she?